This episode contains the taking of 1,200 hostages, most of which were children. There is graphic imagery of killings that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
Sergei Urmanov didn't know what to do. 24 horrific hours had passed since Chechen terrorists had taken him and his family hostage. Alongside the other 1,200 people being held in the Beslan school, the Urmanovs were at their captor's mercy.
But the Chechens were heartless. They had already murdered over 20 men just to prove a point. The terrorists wanted to show the Russian government that they were willing to kill their hostages if they didn't get what they wanted.
But so far, the negotiations had been non-existent. If things didn't change, the terrorists wouldn't have to kill their hostages. The conditions would.
Sergei's niece was diabetic and in desperate need of insulin. If not properly treated, she could slip into a diabetic coma and die.
All Sergei could do was watch as his niece fought for her life. Although the Urmanov family had survived one day as hostages, the nightmare was only just beginning.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help.
As the sun rose on the morning of September 2, 2004, the small Russian town of Beslan was in shock. Thousands of citizens and soldiers stood helplessly outside of the school, powerless to stop the hostage situation unfolding inside its walls.
They had been there all night, listening to the machine gun fire from within the school. The stress was too much for some of the onlookers to bear. Multiple people had to be rushed to the hospital after suffering heart attacks.
The terrorists within the school hadn't slept either. While we don't know for sure, it's believed that they had taken amphetamines to stay awake.
In addition to providing energy, large doses of these drugs also increase hostility and paranoia. Indeed, the hostages had noticed a visible change in the terrorists' moods. They had become more combative with the hostages and one another.
The terrorists were irate that there hadn't been more of an effort in negotiations. Russian officials were still reporting that there were only 354 hostages, instead of the 1,200 that had been taken. It was clear that the government cared more about shaping public perception of the attack than about helping the people trapped inside the school.
With no sign that help was on the way, some of the hostages took matters into their own hands and tried to negotiate the release of children. But the terrorists wouldn't budge. One of them told the hostages, "My children have been shot as well. Do you think your children are better than mine? I have no interest whatsoever in what happens to your children."
Kristen M. Bakke, professor of international relations at University College London, explained that the long war on Chechnya had created an us versus them mentality that dissolved into groupthink.
Groupthink is a failure to see others as individuals. Instead, you only perceive the group. To the Chechen terrorists, the hostages were just as corrupt as any Russian politician, even the children. This mentality allowed the terrorist to dissociate themselves from the individual suffering in front of them.
The lack of empathy meant that as conditions in the gym deteriorated, the hostages couldn't expect any help from their tormentors. And as the late summer sun rose in the sky, they had to contend with a new problem: dehydration.
Inside the gym, temperatures were rising to unbearable heights. The children had all stripped down to their underwear, but even that provided little comfort.
Sergei Ermanov sat with his 7-year-old daughter Zelina and wife Rita. They held each other close as the terrorists debated whether or not the hostages could use the restroom.
Aside from being the only place where the hostages could relieve themselves, the bathrooms were also the only place they could get water. If the terrorists decided to restrict access to the restrooms, the situation was about to get much worse.
Sergei could only hope that his diabetic niece, who had been taken to another room, was being given water. She had gone 24 hours without insulin. She would die if she didn't receive it soon.
In another classroom, mothers and their infants were in an equally dangerous situation. Due to dehydration, the women were unable to produce breast milk. In a rare show of mercy, one of the terrorists found a packet of dried milk for them.
However, this tiny packet was not nearly enough to sustain the infants. Well, thankfully, the hostages were given a glimmer of hope shortly after midday. A negotiator was finally coming to the school.
The government's representative was 49-year-old Ruslan Aushev. As the former president of a Russian republic near Chechnya, Aushev had experience dealing with these political issues. If anyone could get through to the terrorists, it was him.
Aushev entered the gym around 3 p.m., alone and unarmed. He was stunned by the conditions inside. He later said, "The people were stuffed like herring in a barrel. It was a picture of people who knew they were about to die."
Before negotiations began, the terrorists gave Aushev a macabre grand tour of the school. They showed him the 21 corpses of the men that had been killed the day before. Their bodies had been thrown out the window into a pile. Aushev knew that this was intended as a demonstration of their willingness to kill if they didn't get what they wanted.
Once the horrific tour around the school came to an end, Aushev met with the colonel in the teacher's lounge. Aushev asked him to release all the hostages. Unsurprisingly, his request was declined.
On the surface, Aushev's negotiation skills may have seemed suspect. However, according to counterterrorism professor Adam Dolnick, he was operating by the book.
Similar to the first step in the FBI's negotiation guidelines, Aushev had started by asking for the impossible. But by even responding to his request, the colonel showed he was willing to discuss terms. That allowed Aushev to move to the second step, asking for a trade.
Aushev offered himself in place of the hostages. He promised the colonel that if they let the others go, the terrorists would all be given safe passage to Chechnya. With a high-value hostage like Aushev in their grasp, they could even continue negotiating for Russian troops to leave their homeland.
Once again, the colonel refused Aushev's request. However, he was willing to make a gesture of goodwill. He would release mothers and their infant children.
But the concession came with a caveat. Although the mothers could go free, they could only take their breastfeeding infants. All of their older children were to remain hostages.
This ultimatum put the mothers into an incredibly difficult position. They were being forced to choose between saving their babies' lives and remaining with their other children. One of these mothers was Aneta Gadieva, whose 9-year-old daughter, Alana, was a student at the school.
Aneta had made the decision to bring her infant daughter, Milena, to the school's Day of Knowledge celebration. It was a choice that would haunt her for the rest of her life.
Aneta begged the colonel to allow 9-year-old Alana to carry out Milena in her place. but the terrorist refused. Annetta had to choose, and she had to choose now.
Annetta felt the physical desire to push both her children back into her womb. Of course, that was impossible, but so was the choice she was being forced to make.
And yet, she had to make it. In the end, Annetta decided to leave with her baby. Staying behind wouldn't do anything to save Alana, and little Milena would have never made it through another night in the school.
But Alana and the other children being left behind were too young to understand why their mothers were leaving without them. Their desperate pleas proved too difficult for one of the mothers to resist.
Annetta's neighbor Fatima was there with three of her children, two older boys, ages 4 and 10, and an 8-month-old daughter. But she couldn't bring herself to leave any of her children behind. In a moment of panic, she handed her baby to Ruslan Aushev.
Aushev was unsure if this would be permitted, but he had children of his own. He knew what a difficult situation this was. He vowed to do everything it took to get this baby out of the school. Much to his surprise, he was able to take the baby to safety with no protest from the terrorists.
When Annetta saw that Fatima had stayed and was still able to send out her baby, she felt extreme guilt. It was a guilt shared by all the mothers who left their children behind.
Despite this unimaginable pain, the people of Beslan were relieved to see some of the hostages go free. In total, 26 people were released, 11 mothers and 15 infants.
After dropping off Fatima's baby, Ruslan Aushev assumed he would be going back to the school to negotiate for the release of more hostages. However, the terrorists wouldn't let him in until he completed an errand for them.
Just before Aushev left the school, the colonel had given him a handwritten letter from the terrorist leader, Shamil Basayev. Although Basayev wasn't at the school, he had orchestrated the whole crisis.
The letter was addressed to Russian President Vladimir Putin. It acknowledged that Putin hadn't started the war with Chechnya, but he could end it. Basayev promised that if Russian troops were removed from Chechen soil, all turmoil between the two countries would stop.
The letter ended thusly. The Chechen people are conducting a battle for national freedom, for their own independence and autonomy, for self-preservation, and not in order to destroy Russia or diminish it. We offer you peace, but the choice is yours to make.
Ruslan passed along the letter, but Putin never replied. In fact, he refused all of the colonel's numerous requests to speak with him. Until one of the two sides caved, the remaining hostages would stay in the school.
In an attempt to force the government's hand, the terrorists decided to cut the hostages off from the restrooms. By extension, this meant they were cut off from any water source.
Although some of the hostages had stolen small drinks from the bathroom tap, many others were going on 2 days without water.
On average, a healthy human can survive around 3 days without water. If the government didn't take action, the hostages would all be dead within 24 hours.
And the lack of access to the restroom presented another obvious problem for the hostages. There was nowhere for them to relieve themselves.
The gunman in the gym ordered some of the older students to dig up the floorboards and create a hole. That hole was now meant to be the restroom for over 1,000 people.
Faced with this dire situation, no water and no toilet, many of the hostages were forced to drink their own urine, either from plastic water bottles or sucking it from their clothing. It seems impossible that the terrorists were able to stand by and watch children resort to something like this, but they were able to act so callously because of dehumanization, viewing their hostages as if they lacked human emotions or qualities.
We mentioned earlier that the us versus them mentality of the Chechen captors caused them to see their hostages merely as Russian enemies instead of individuals. G. Tendaiviki, the senior lecturer of psychology at the University of Kent, explained that dehumanization deactivates the region of a person's brain that's responsible for seeing the mental states of others.
Dehumanization has a strong link to torture, both physical and mental. By not seeing their hostages as human, the terrorists were able to treat them in ways most people couldn't.
But as bad as things were now, they were about to get worse. Soon, the lack of water would be the least of their problems.
Coming up, we'll talk about the final bloody day of the Beslan crisis.
Thank you so much for listening. We want to take this time to tell you that Hostage will be taking the next 2 weeks off. We'll be back with a new bonus episode on January 7th and resuming our regular schedule on January 9th. In the meantime, we do have a special gift to share with you. While we're away, we'll be airing our listeners' most requested episodes of 2019. If you'd like to check out the most requested episodes from Parcast's other shows, subscribe to Parcast Presents to hear our best of 2019. From everyone here at Parcast, we'd like to wish you a happy holiday season. We're thankful for your support, and we look forward to bringing you even more unique and entertaining podcasts in the new year. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the story.
On the morning of September 3rd, 2004, the sun came up on what would be known as one of the most tragic days in Russian history.
As the minutes ticked by, Beslan's citizens grew angrier and angrier. People inside the school were dying, and it seemed like the Russian government wasn't doing anything about it.
Although Sergei Urmanov had survived another night in the Beslan school, his diabetic niece had not. At the end of the second day, she slipped into a coma and passed away during the night.
It had been 20 hours since Ruslan Aushev had attempted to negotiate with the terrorist, and all hope appeared to be lost. The hostages around Sergei were hysterically crying. Many were suffering from hallucinations brought on by dehydration.
One delirious child stood up and announced that he was going to visit his grandpa and have some water at his house. Frantically, his mother pulled him to the ground and held him down to keep him from being shot.
But all hope wasn't lost after all. Although negotiators weren't allowed into the school, the Russian government was keeping a dialogue open with the terrorists, most likely via telephone.
After lengthy discussions, the colonel said he would allow for the bodies of the 21 murdered men to be collected by military personnel.
Four unarmed soldiers approached the school around noon. The people gathered in front of the school feared this was a cruel trick. They thought the terrorists might open fire on the defenseless men.
The four soldiers reached the bodies without incident. But just as they picked up the first body, the unthinkable happened. A bomb went off inside the school.
The most likely explanation is that one of the bombs placed in the basketball hoops slipped through the net and went off.
No one was prepared for the explosion, not even the Chechen terrorists. The gym was in utter chaos.
Sergei's wife, Rita, was instantly killed in the explosion. But Sergei had no time to grieve. His 7-year-old daughter, Zelina, was still alive, and he had to protect her at all cost. Another blast might happen at any moment.
The explosion had created a hole in the floor near Sergei, surrounded by 3 dead bodies. He put Zelina in the hole and covered her with his own body, then piled the 3 corpses on top of them. His intuition was correct. Moments later, a second bomb went off.
bodies and limbs flew across the gym and through the windows. Due to the strong heat from the blasts, the survivors believed they were on fire.
Sergei was barely conscious, but he and Zelina had once again survived. Even as flames engulfed the gym, Sergei decided to lay still. He hoped the terrorists would mistake his bloodied body for a corpse. Once everyone fled the burning gym, Sergei and Zelina could make a run for it.
But not all of the survivors had Sergei's patience. Many of the hostages started climbing through the windows, running for safety.
Some of the children stopped running a few meters from the school, assuming they were safe. Others stopped once they hit an outdoor faucet in the schoolyard.
This made them easy targets for the Chechen snipers that had been in place from the beginning. Multiple people were killed while taking their first drink of water in days. Amid all the explosions and gunfire, local police were too stunned to react. They were completely unprepared for this sort of chaos. The only hope for the remaining hostages was the Russian military.
But despite having had over 42 hours to prepare, the military was just as woefully unprepared as the Beslan police. There was an extreme lack of organization and communication from their response team, leaving the soldiers to wildly fire at any terrorist they saw.
Ordinary people armed with guns opened fire on the school as well. But with hostages still inside and surrounded by undetonated bombs, the citizens' gunshots were only placing their loved ones in more danger.
Amidst the chaos, citizens and military officials alike were running towards the school and bringing back as many hostages as they could. Many brave souls lost their lives this way. Inside, the remaining hostages had two goals: find their loved ones and escape from the school. Even with fleeing hostages being shot at, risking death by gunshot was a better option than burning alive.
But finding their family members was easier said than done. Many of the survivors were rendered temporarily deaf or concussed from the explosions. And in the confusion, many of the blood and debris-covered hostages looked the same. Mothers even struggled to recognize their own children.
Sergei was still with his daughter, but he didn't know how long they could keep hiding.
Even though the terrorists were yelling for any survivors to get up, Sergei whispered for Zelina to remain down on the ground. He did his best to cover her eyes so she wouldn't see the bodies all around them, including her own mother's.
It was a miracle that Sergei and Zelina weren't hit by any stray bullets. He didn't dare lift his head to see what was happening. If he was discovered alive, he would certainly be shot.
As Sergei huddled on the ground, he heard a man calling out in his native tongue. He was telling the survivors to follow his voice. Help had finally arrived.
Sergei only dared to move after he heard the man call out several times. Carrying Zelina in his arms, he rose up and cautiously headed towards the voice.
Bullets whizzed past Sergei as he walked across what he described as a carpet of corpses and living people. But instead of reaching safe haven, he was only walking into more danger.
The voice Sergei had heard belonged to one of the Chechen terrorists who had grown up near Beslan and spoke their dialect. He used this tactic to lure in several of the survivors.
Once they were within grasp, Sergei and Zelina were ordered to the cafeteria. He held Zelina tight and covered her eyes as they marched past a line of injured hostages.
Despite the cruel trick, they'd left the gym at precisely the right moment. Only moments later, a third bomb detonated.
The injured people that Sergei had just passed were instantly killed.
Things were no better outside of the school as hostages continued to make the deadly run to safety. Many of them were horribly burned from the fire and barely able to stand. The people looking on were powerless to help.
One of them was a crisis photographer named Dmitry Bilyakov. He could only watch in horror as a young girl stood up in the school courtyard. He screamed for her to get down. She was directly in the kill zone, but she didn't heed his words. Instead of running away, she did something even worse. She walked back towards the school.
One of the soldiers watching this scene unfold desperately called into his walkie-talkie. He wanted permission to shoot the young girl in the leg in order to save her life.
The affirmative response came too late. Likely deaf to the onlooker's screams, she hoisted herself up into a window and crawled back into the burning school.
Dmitry put down his camera. Consumed with grief, he was unable to watch her any longer.
Instead, he turned his focus to the other escaped hostages who needed help. Just because they had gotten out of the school, that didn't mean they were safe.
Coming up, Beslan struggles to deal with this horrific crisis.
Now, the conclusion to our story.
It was September 3rd, 2004, the third day of the Beslan crisis, and there were still nearly 300 hostages trapped within the burning school. Although the three bomb explosions had caused devastating damage, they had also created the perfect opportunity for the Russian military to make its move.
By the time the soldiers entered the school, the roof had collapsed and the fire was raging out of control. They were going in blind. The soldiers had no idea that about half of the 32 terrorists were still alive, or that the remaining hostages had been moved to the cafeteria. Sergei Urmanov and his 7-year-old daughter, Zelina, were among them.
Sergei watched helplessly as the gunmen forced mothers to hoist their children into windowsills. It seemed to be a strategy to discourage people from shooting at the building.
It didn't work. Two of the mothers were killed as they approached the windows.
It was unclear to Sergei which side of the fight had killed the two women, whether they were misguided soldiers or hidden Chechen snipers, but there was no time to think about it. Immediately after the women fell to the ground, a shell came through the window.
Once again, Sergei threw himself over Zelina, but this time he was unable to shield her from the blast.
The shell exploded between Zelina and the wall, sending shrapnel everywhere. While Sergei frantically cleared the burning metal away from his daughter, he was shot in the spine.
He fell to the ground, consumed with the pain. He tried to get to Zelina, but he couldn't move. He could only watch as his 7-year-old daughter died just a few feet away.
Moments later, Russian soldiers burst into the cafeteria. As the terrorists tried to fight back, children ran into their savior's arms and right into the line of fire.
The situation became even more chaotic when the military used tanks to fire holes into the school's walls. Government officials tried to soothe the angry crowds by telling them the holes were escape routes for the hostages.
But the holes served another purpose. They became a point of entry for the gathered citizens who were sick of sitting on the sidelines.
The rushing crowds of armed civilians were too much for the terrorists to overcome. It wasn't long until every last one of them had been killed. The hostage crisis was over, but the survivors were still far from safe.
A As rescuers combed the school, Sergei heard someone ask if anyone was still alive. Although he was covered in dead bodies, Sergei managed to raise his arm. The last thing he remembered before losing consciousness was being picked up and passed through a window.
He woke up to a beating from members of the special forces. They had mistaken him for a terrorist. He was hit so hard that the stretcher he was laying on ripped.
Eventually, a bystander recognized Sergei and convinced the soldiers to stop beating him. Finally, he was safe.
However, it was of little comfort to him. He may have escaped with his life, but he had lost his family. As the last survivors were rounded up, Russian officials were woefully unprepared for the flood of injured hostages. Even though the crisis had been going on for more than 2 full days, there weren't nearly enough ambulances at the ready. Children were being taken to hospitals in their loved ones' cars. Some were even forced to ride in the trunk. Other parents had to carry their children several miles to get medical attention.
Even those that did snag an ambulance faced their own dilemma. Many of the out-of-town drivers had no idea where the hospitals were. It was up to the shocked and traumatized patients to give them directions.
The few hostages who did escape uninjured were left desperately searching for their families. There were some joyous reunions, but they were few and far between.
For the most part, the survivors had to rush to the morgues and hospitals to learn the fates of their loved ones.
Among them was Aneta Gadieva, the mother who had been forced to leave her daughter Alana in the school. After days of visiting hospitals and morgues, she received news that Alana had died. She was only able to identify her daughter's badly burnt body by her earrings.
Aneta later learned the fate of her neighbor Fatima, who had stayed with her older children. Tragically, Fatima and her 10-year-old son had died together. However, her 4-year-old son had miraculously survived. He and his baby sister were 2 of the 24 children orphaned by the attack.
Despite the horrific tragedy in Beslan, there were moments of happiness and relief. Crisis photographer Dmitry Belyakov had assumed that the young girl he had seen crawl back into the school was dead. But days later, he found her alive in the hospital.
She had been badly burnt, but was on the road to a full recovery. She told him she had gone back into the school to find her mother. They had both survived. They were some of the lucky ones. In total, over 330 hostages had been killed, 188 of whom were children. Over 700 were injured, over half of them children.
For those who survived, the government provided little solace. President Putin didn't arrive in Beslan until after the siege was over. He stayed so briefly that his plane engine was kept running.
The people of Beslan were furious at the lack of response. It seemed like the government was spinning the facts to make the attack seem less tragic than it really was.
For instance, the government claimed there were 32 terrorists at the school, while the hostages have recalled there being somewhere between 50 and 70.
It's possible that the 32 figure was based off the number of bodies that were found. But this tally doesn't take into account that some of the terrorists may have escaped. Perhaps officials were eager for a victory and wanted to announce that all the terrorists had been killed or detained. However, this claim has left survivors wondering if some of their captors are still out there living freely.
There have been 3 Russian investigations into the Beslan school crisis, but no government official has been accused of any wrongdoing. However, in 2017, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that the Russian government had failed to protect the hostages. As of 2019, all independent investigations into the matter have stalled.
Most of the inside information we have about the hostage situation comes, in a roundabout way, from the terrorists themselves. Weeks after the attack, local Beslan teenagers found a video recorder the captors had used.
The video from the recorder shows the takeover from the terrorist point of view, the hostages, the men who were killed, and the negotiations with Ruslan Aushev.
This footage provided the only glimpse of the colonel. He could be seen walking towards the camera with an assault rifle. He was relaxed, smiling, and laughing. If he was bothered at all about what he was doing to his roughly 1,200 hostages, he didn't show it.
It's widely accepted that the colonel died in the Beslan siege. Shamil Basayev, the man behind the attack, was killed 2 years later in 2006. Both deaths were a victory for the people of Beslan, but it still wasn't enough to relieve the pain.
In 2007, a voluntary study was done on a group of Beslan children to measure their PTSD from the crisis. When asked how they coped with the reminders of the attack, 13% said they had no coping mechanisms, 12% of them avoided the subject, and 36% used distraction as a coping mechanism. Only 26% had found an active coping mechanism that worked for them.
15 years after the attack, Beslan has been left with an open wound that will likely never heal. The school remains a memorial to those that were killed in the crisis. Loved ones leave full water bottles at the site, so the 330 people who died will never again know thirst.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We will be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals like Hostage for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound designed by Trent Williamson, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Freddie Beckley, and Joel Stein. This episode of Hostage was written by Claire Linick, with writing assistance by Maggie Admire, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.
Just a reminder that we'll be back with a new bonus episode on January 7th and resuming our regular schedule on January 9th. In the meantime, we'll be playing our listeners' most requested episodes of 2019. Thanks again for listening. We hope you have a wonderful holiday season.